get along with better.
The House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance will come to order. The committee legislative assistant will call the roll.
Chairman Smith?
Present.
Vice Chair Szymanski?
Present.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Anderson?
Here.
Representative Champion?
Here.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Greenhagen?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom? Representative Creasel?
Here.
Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lesh?
Here.
Representative Liebling?
Here.
Representative Mazarow?
Here.
Representative Maleen?
Here.
Representative Schumacher?
Here.
Representative Vogel?
Present.
Representative Vogel?
Present.
Okay. The quorum is present. In your package, you have the minutes from previous meeting. May I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved. So moved,
Representative
Mr. Chair.
Vogel moves the minutes of the April 14th, 2011 hearing. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Okay. The chair would now like to bring House File 56 by Representative Dill back before the committee. The chair moves that House File 56 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Is there any discussion on House File 56? Hearing no further discussion, the chair renews the motion that a House File 56 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. House File 56 is recommended to pass and re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. Okay. Representative Ward. Good morning, Representative Ward.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. The chair would now like to bring House File 1162 by Representative Ward before the committee. Do I have a motion to move House File 1162?
So moved.
Representative Liebling moves House File 1162 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. The chair now recognizes Representative Ward to explain House File 1162.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and welcome back to all of us. I hope everybody had a great, relaxing, and enjoyable family Easter break. Members, I have with me today Luke Skinner from the DNR, and then I think there's some other testifiers as well, but I'm just going to introduce the bill members, and then we'll have some testimony on the bill. And I'm sorry I was a little bit late. I looked at the agenda, Mr. Chair, and I saw that I was down on the calendar, so I was doing a radio interview and about this bill, so I'm sorry that I was a little bit late. Members, I'm here to ask for your support for House File 1162, a bill that has the potential to impact every corner of our great state, either positively or negatively that will be impacted, depending upon the outcome of this very important piece of legislation. House File 1162 deals with working to protect our lakes and other water resources by preventing the spread of aquatic invasive species, otherwise known as AIS. We in Minnesota live in some of the most envious natural beauty, have some of the most beautiful resources and natural habitat in the nation, maybe even in the world, members. Aquatic invasive species threaten to turn those resources into the dead seas if we don't take care of them. We must work to protect and preserve our water resources for the next generation, passing on that beautiful environment that we were blessed with, that was given to us in order to our children and our grandchildren to have that beautiful water resources that we were given. Our state relies heavily also, members, on our tourism industry. Our tourism industry in the state of Minnesota is an $11 billion industry. And we know the need for every penny of revenue that we can get in the state of Minnesota. The tourism industry also provides 240,000 plus jobs, part-time or full-time jobs, for our citizens in the state of, in the state of Minnesota. As long as we protect and preserve our waters, members, our tourism industry, and those jobs and that revenue will remain strong. If our lakes become the Dead Sea and infested with aquatic invasive species spreading, our tourism industry is likely to have major repercussions. This bill is the result of many meetings over the last 2 years, which included many stakeholders. The language in this bill are the recommendations of the stakeholder group to tackle the aquatic invasive species problem. The bill contains a number of policy and technical changes related to AIS and aquatic plant management. This initiative is intended to increase efforts to prevent the transportation and spread of AIS by providing more authority for inspections and enforcement, raising penalties for violation, requiring service provider permits, restricting the use of nets and equipment in infested waters, expanding training requirements to service providers and bait harvesting workers, and requiring decals to be displayed on watercraft for aquatic invasive species education. Mr. Chair, members, I have with me, as I said, Lou Skinner today to testify and further explain individual pieces of House File 1162, and then any other testimony, Mr. Chair, and then at the end I'll have some closing comments.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Luke Skinner. I supervise the Department of Natural Resources and Invasive Species Program. Mr. Chair, would you like me to walk through every part, or are there key portions of the bill would you like to touch on?
Give us a brief overview of the bill. Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill, I'll kind of walk through some of it. In the first section, sections 1 through 9, 1 through 8, are all definitions requiring that describe what's going to be in this bill. Including inspections, service providers, transport, and also water-related equipment, which will be discussed further. So some of this is cleanup and technical changes to and strengthen what's currently in there. But some of the key portions of the bill require are going around inspection authorities and increased enforcement and penalties, as Representative Ward had just mentioned. So there is some things in Section 8 and Section 9 are talking about annual reports, just increasing, changing those, and bait harvest infested waters. And with this particular bait harvest in Section 9 is really about using nets, allowing change that allows the use of nets only in infested waters. So they have to have separate nets for the bait harvest in separate waters. As we move on into Sections 11, and Section 11 really, again, is cleanup. And is saying that when removing water-related equipment from waters of the state, the purpose of cleaning off aquatic macrophytes before leaving an access. So all that does say is that right now it's illegal to transport aquatic plants and water from on public roads. And this will say that at least when you pull your boat out of the water, you have the opportunity to clean it first before moving. Section 13. Revises language that provides authority for conservation officers and authorized inspectors around water-related equipment, and particularly talking about the removal of aquatic macrophytes and other species from water-related equipment before it's placed in the waters of the state, and that conservation officers or other species officers may order that. Section 14 now clarifies, again, about transport of water-related equipment, now includes portable bait containers. That's the big difference. If you remember, last year there was a law passed, we called it the drain plug law, where it requires you to drain all your water from all your boats, your water-related equipment. Last year, put your drain plug, live wells, bait buckets, except for bait buckets. Now this would include all water-related equipment, including bait buckets. That would have to be removed. Mr. Chairman, the big change starts really in Section 15, inspections of watercraft and water-related equipment. Subdivision 1 under line 7.1 is compliance inspections, which would require inspections. An inspector may prohibit launch if refusal to allow inspection, and saying that inspections are express condition of operating a watercraft in the state. Subdivision 2 under line 7.7 is inspection authority, giving the commissioner the authority to train and authorize inspectors. And inspectors includes not only those authorized inspectors, but conservation officers and also local peace officers. Section B actually gives that authority to the conservation officer or other licensed police officers may inspect any watercraft or water-aided equipment that is stopped at a water access or stopped anywhere at any other location in the state if the officer determines that there's a reason to believe that aquatic invasive species or aquatic macrophytes are present. Section C, Part C under Subdivision 2, Line 7.20, would allow for check stations to be used at locations in proximity to locations where watercraft or other water-related equipment is placed in the state. So it would be a mobile check stations for those coming or leaving near public water access. Under Section 16 is about permits required for lake service providers. A lake service provider is somebody who is for hire moving docks, boat lifts, and boats from lake to lake or on and off a shoreline, and they're one of the key vectors to spread along with recreational boaters, and this would require them to be permitted in the state, and they training required on an every 3-year basis. Section 18 under line 8.13, currently all of these violations for transport are criminal violations, misdemeanors, and this would extend to the transport of aquatic plants. Right now, aquatic plants is only under civil penalty. Under Section 19, clarifies that civil citation authorities apply to all water-related equipment. So this is an extension beyond just the boats that were the previous year. Section 20 is around civil penalties, and in this current bill, we would be doubling most of the civil penalty amounts and higher penalties for those who continue to violate the law, which would be doubling those who violate the law. In Section 22 on line 10.5 would allow for local law enforcement who issue citations to retain the penalties collected. Section 24, in Section 24, line 10.21, would require a decal for all watercraft users. So anybody who owns a boat would have to have a decal on their boat that says what the rules are and what you have to do when you leave a lake. And so this would be, has to be in full view of the operator of the watercraft. This is currently done for personal watercraft, and this would be extended for invasive species to all watercraft in the state. And sections 26 and 27, or 27, I'm 26, I'm yeah, section 26, line 11.8 has to do with just allowing for aquatic plant management permits to be valid for the entire year, so it allows us to do more management on lakes, and also defines what an invasive species plant, aquatic plant management permit is, and also allows for a relaxed, be able to obtain signatures. When you go out and you treat a lake and you do a lake-wide, you have to get signatures from all the property owners, and on some lakes where it's very large, where you may have 600 or 700 landowners, it's very burdensome to be able to go and get all those. So this allows just other alternative ways to get notification out before treatment is complete. Section 27, for the temporary warning requirements of aquatic invasive species rule decal, just says it will not, that there will not result in a penalty until July 1, 2012. So it gives a year grace period. With that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I can answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who this question is for, maybe staff, but looking at Section 26 regarding invasive aquatic plant management permit on rule, on, I'm sorry, on line 11.12, where it refers to the rules, part 628.0100, subpart 2B. My question is just, if we refer to a rule in statute, does that solidify the rule as is as of the date of the statute's enactment, or if the rule changes thereafter, if the department or commission were to change the rule, does that, that could that then change the effect of the statute?
Additional? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe the agency would have the ability to change the rules since their authority would be in the statute, so I believe it could change. But I haven't looked into that question specifically before.
Any other questions? Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question on Section 24. So you're a watercraft owner, then you have to display this aquatic. Is there a fee for that?
Mr. Chairman.
Mrs. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no, there would be no fee for that. That would be part of our invasive species program budget, and we would provide those out to everywhere in the state, to boat dealers, bait shops. We'd be handing them out, so we make them free to, just so they have that those directions.
Okay. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Skinner, on that, to follow up on that same question, you said no fee. There was something mentioned about no fee until 2012. Would there be a fee in subsequent years?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Skinner.
Members of the committee, that was about a penalty. So if you do not have the decal on your boat, you're subject to a penalty. So you're in violation of the law. So saying that there's going to be a grace period for up to a year, so we can educate people, make sure everybody gets the decals prior to being enforced.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, one more question. On Section 23, the receipts, money received from surcharges on watercraft licenses, basically deposited to the invasive species account, but that's not the, I guess that's not the section. It'd be Section 22, the civil penalties. Part 2, where the funds would be turned over to the Treasury of the unit of government employing the officer issuing this civil citation. Is there a fiscal note, any prediction on what that may do? Or
Mr. Chairman, just to give you an idea, last year there was 159 civil citations written and received for about $4,000. So if a portion of those are written, so it depends how many tickets are written in the field, but yes, there was some information. Even if it was doubled and that was done by local units of government, you can expect that 150 tickets, you're going to bring in about that much money.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, ask one more question. The personal watercraft, the jet ski type of thing, would that be subject to the same inspections and decal requirements?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Skinner.
Yes, all watercraft and all water-related equipment would be subject to this provision.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Any other testifiers?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jeff Forster, and I am Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners Association. We represent 122,000 seasonal property owners around the state, and we're kind of on the front line of this issue. A lot of us have lakeshore, and we've seen, and we're very involved in taking care of the lakes, and have seen the spread of AIS throughout the state. In the last few years, what we've seen is the explosion of zebra mussels, which is a very devastating invasive species. Not only will it impact the lakes, but it impacts water systems for cities, irrigation. It can get into irrigation ditches, destroys boats. It's a really bad organism. And so we support this bill strongly and believe that the fines and the penalties should be commensurate with the risk and the crime. Someone who imports invasive species into a lake could cause hundreds of millions of dollars of damage for years, every year. There's no way to get rid of zebra mussels once they're introduced. There's no way to manage them. They're a very successful organism. And so we would urge that you approve this bill. Thank you. If there's any questions, I can stand for questions.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other testimony? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in conclusion, there was a gentleman, members at the last committee, his name was Dave Zettner. He's from Duluth. And when Mr. Zettner was in his late teens, early 20s, Lake Superior was under attack by a number of species that, you know, threatened Lake Superior at that time. And at that time, our state leaders took some bold measures and courageous measures to make sure that our waterways, Lake Superior, but other waterways, were preserved and protected for future generations, you know, reserving the most precious resource that we might have in the state of Minnesota, our lakes and our waterways. And members, we're at a crossroads. We're at a crossroads for the protection and preservation of our state waterways in the state of Minnesota, and it's up to us to take that bold and courageous measure again. We have, as zebra mussel is one of the most frequent aquatic invasive species talked about. We have 19 lakes in the state of Minnesota infested with them right now. Let's not have number 20 in any of our districts, in any of our districts or anywhere in the state of Minnesota. And members, one of the last things I'll say is that this bill is not a Democrat bill. It's not a Republican bill. It's not an independent bill, not a House bill, not a Senate bill, not a governor. It's a Minnesota bill. It's about the citizens and the resources that we have in the state of Minnesota and protecting and preserving them for our future generations and for the importance of our future generations as well, and our jobs and our industries in the state of Minnesota rely on our waterways. So, Mr. Chair and members, I ask for your support to make sure that one of our most valuable resources, our lakes and our waterways, are preserved and protected from the debilitating spread of aquatic invasive species. Thank you.
Very good. If there's no other witnesses, the testimony is concluded. Representative Liebling, your motion?
Chair, I would renew my motion. And where is the bill going?
Civil.
It's a civil law. Yeah. I renew my motion that House File 1162 be recommended to pass and go to civil law.
Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Ward, do you need to have the page escort you back to your radio interview?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. We're waiting for some authors. All right, I think what we'll do at this time, Representative Mazzaro, House File 747. Anyone wishing to testify on this bill, raise your hand. All right. Representative Mazzaro, what motion would you like?
The motion is to pass House File 747 to be recommended to civil law.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, this is a bill that actually contains two provisions. The first provides that an award of attorney's fees must take into account their reasonableness in relation to the damages awarded. And secondly, it provides, and this is the primary portion of the bill, provides that a party rejecting a reasonable offer of judgment under Rule 68 bears the risk of their additional attorney's fees after service of the offer of judgment when that verdict does not exceed the offer amount. And I have with me Attorney Tom Marshall to testify regarding this bill.
Yes.
State your name.
Tom Marshall. I'm an attorney in practices in Minneapolis. I'm also the past president of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill this morning. This is an important bill in the sense of we have over, I think, 300 statutes in Minnesota that deal with the award of attorney's fees in civil litigation. Some of those deal with cases involving employment law, which I routinely deal with. Others deal with other things from consumer protections to timber being taken. There's many, many statutes that deal with this issue. Unfortunately, the questions remain as to what we do with these situations involving attorney's fees when reasonable settlement offers are made by parties to try to resolve disputes and what happens and what the bill intends to do is to provide a clear line and guidance for courts to deal with these issues. The first part of the statute deals with the issue of reasonable relation of fees to damages. And this comes from a federal court decisions, the first one being a Supreme Court decision called Merrick versus Chesney. And what the courts ultimately do in federal law and what the courts used to do in Minnesota, and we'll get to that in a minute, was to apply what was called a critical factor of the degree of success obtained when courts would determine whether attorney's fees would be ordered where a person had made a reasonable settlement offer that had been refused by the party who received the offer. The second part of the statute deals more importantly with the issue of attorney's fees and what happens to them when a reasonable offer is refused. What happens to the attorney's fees to the party who has prevailed in one sense by obtaining a judgment but has not prevailed in the sense of a offer of judgment because they haven't done as well as what the offer of judgment has done. And that was less of an issue before 2008, 2009 when our courts adopted what's called a new Rule 68. Rule 68 used to provide that if a party made an offer of judgment before trial, in other words, saying, look, we agree to let judgment be entered against us for X amount of dollars. The courts used to take that and would say, all right, what happened in the end result? If the plaintiff in that instance did not do as well and it was a fee-shifting case, the courts, again, relying on Supreme Court and state court precedent, would say, okay, we're not going to necessarily award you attorney's fees incurred after you refused a reasonable offer to resolve your case. Rule 68 has changed. Now the rule provides that if a reasonable offer is refused, it has no effect on attorney's fees that might be awarded. And unfortunately, this has had a very chilling effect on the use of Rule 68 in our court system. It has only added to the burden of the courts by hearing cases which otherwise would probably be disposed of by reasonable offers. But it also has created a fundamental unfairness. It also has encouraged cases not to resolve, which was the whole purpose of Rule 68. It has undermined the purpose completely. And so what the bill provides is that when a person makes an offer, a reasonable offer of settlement, the court can take that into account and not award attorney's fees for the person who refuses a reasonable offer. It essentially puts in what the law had been prior to the change in Rule 68, which encourages parties not to resolve disputes. Now, I can describe for you several instances, and I think the best example is just from the other day for me. I'm involved in a wage case. Damages are liquidated. There's no dispute as to what the damages are. And actually it comes out of whether or not vacation pay is owed to certain people, and the vacation pay is set in hours, and there's a dispute of whether or not to pay it under a contract theory, but whether or not the damages are liquidated and we've made offers of settlement. The offers of settlement were refused, with plaintiffs doing extensive discovery of depositions in other parts of the country. Noting them, they ultimately didn't take some of them. Depositions of people, well, one they took in Atlanta, Georgia, of a person. Now, it's hard to understand what would justify taking depositions in Atlanta and bringing people into Minnesota to take depositions on a claim that's worth $5,000 when the defendant has made an offer of $5,000. Of course, the attorney's fees are not capped and they aren't affected if the person receives a judgment. It's very troubling, and it encourages this kind of behavior, the present rule. I can give you any number of those because every case ultimately boils down to attorney's fees and what one party may owe or may not owe. And if the legislature and our courts are really interested in encouraging the settlement of disputes reasonably, and this won't affect, obviously, people making unreasonable offers of resolve for a dollar or something like that, but if they really encourage the resolution of disputes on a reasonable basis, this bill will solve a lot of issues for parties.
Questions, Representative Lesh?
Thank you. And I'm sorry, would the testifier state his name again?
My My name is Tom Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Mr. Marshall, how was Rule 68 enacted?
How was Rule 68? I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Rule 68 was originally a court rule. I think it was enacted in the 50s when the, I think Minnesota adopted the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, or the very similar rule similar to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, then so that was enacted by. I mean, did we have a judicial council back then, or how was that implemented by court action? Was it just through the Supreme Court adopted it?
Mr. Marshall,
Mr. Chair, Representative, the as I understand it, yes, that's correct. The Supreme Court would adopt the rules, and they promulgate them as the rule Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, if I can, Mr. Marshall, then what would happen if a district court just declined to follow Rule 68, if a district court judge handed down a finding in opposition to what the rule would state?
Mr. Marshall.
Representatives, Mr. Chairman. Well, the court would have an issue because would it be considered an abuse of discretion for the court to have done that? Obviously, if a court refused to follow the basic statement of the rule, certainly there would be an issue whether this was an abuse of discretion to the appellate courts or a decision which would be clearly erroneous depending on what the appellate standard would be.
Okay, Mr. Chair, one other question. Well, Mr. Marshall, I guess my question is if this rule has been in place in Minnesota for 50, 60 years, assuming that it's for good reason and wondering why we want to change it now, from what I can see, if I'm an employee and I've got an employment law case, the company has lawyers on their side, and if I'm going to get going, I got to have gas in the car. I don't have gas in the car without any lawyers, and that's going to affect whether or not an attorney is going to take my case. If the company has lawyers and I've got no lawyers, I got to go shopping for a lawyer to take my case. Don't they have to see that they stand the chance of getting reasonable attorney's fees? And isn't that slanting the field against employees and in favor of employers?
Mr. Marshall. Representative, I would disagree completely. First of all, the premise that this rule has been there for 50, 60 years is incorrect because the present rule has only been there for 2.5 years. The present rule was changed effective July 1st of 2008. And under the former Rule 68, the difference would be no different than what we're proposing in the bill today.
Okay, can I qualify my question?
Representative Lesch,
that was the question I thought I was asking. How was the rule changed then 2.5 years ago? If it wasn't handed down with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure as adopted by the Supreme Court in the 50s, how was it changed here in Minnesota 2.5 years ago?
Mr. Marshall. Right. Mr. Chair, Representative, the Minnesota's had a Rule 68 for many years. Rule 68 was amended in 2000, effective July 1st of 2008, by the Supreme Court at that time.
Okay.
Representative Lesch.
Was that by the Judicial Council then, Mr. Marshall, that did that, made that change? Or who actually made the change when you just say the Supreme Court?
Mr. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there was a rules process that was done. There was a committee of, as I understand it, 25 people. Whether that's called the Judicial Council or not, frankly, I don't know. Ultimately, the proposed amendments to that rule and others were proposed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court adopted them.
Okay. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So did you get an opportunity, or did anyone get an opportunity to weigh in on that at the time when these changes were made? Did you send a letter or anything to the Supreme Court?
Mr. Marshall.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we did, Your Honor, our representative. Okay.
Thank you. No further questions, sir.
Thank you. Any other questions at this time?
Representative Fogle. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Marshall or Representative Masrell, would this bring us back in line with the federal rule more so than, I mean, it seems to me that we must have moved away a bit from the federal rule by this change 2.5 years ago?
Mr. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it would. And that's basically the intention of the rule, and I didn't get a chance to finish my response to the other gentleman's inquiries concerning about whether a lawyer would take your case. And I take, for example, another case that we've had over the last couple of years, a drug testing case. Minnesota has a very severe drug testing requirements. It basically creates strict liability. And if, for example, if an employer tests somebody without having a drug testing policy, well, they're in trouble. They violated the law. And there's not much they can do about it. In one drug testing case, for example, the offered person reinstatement and ultimately offered to make him whole, plus paid him, offered him a certain amount of money in attorney's fees early on in the case, essentially right after suit. The attorney said no, because I'm giving up my fee claim and I can take fees. In that case, they noted depositions in California on a case where the defendant was offering essentially what the plaintiff lost and giving him his job back. That's what we're trying to guard against, because the incentive under the current Rule 68, which wasn't there under the former Rule 68, would create the risk that the party, if they're deciding to go forward and turn down an offer, well, then they'll be responsible for their own fees from that point. Somebody else isn't going to pay them. Up to that point, they are still paid their fees. So it's a fairly modest proposal in that sense.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the point, Mr. Marshall, when I look at the bill here, of requiring a party to disclose their fees while still in the process of litigating the case? What is that?
Mr. Marshall.
What's the point of that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson. The purpose is if, for example, and I believe it's the Merrick case. In that case, the defendant had made an offer, I think, of $55,000 at earlier in the point of litigation. Actually, maybe a little more, but I think the ultimate decision was $55,000. Plaintiffs in that case claimed $170,000 in attorney's fees, but at the time the offer was made, those fees were $32,000. And the reason that provision is in there is so the court can measure the substantiveness of the defendant's offer as reasonable. For example, if 10 days before trial, a defendant would make an offer judgment for $50,000 and a plaintiff at that point in time, and the ultimate judgment, let's say, was $30,000. Well, 10 days for trial after a year of discovery, the attorney's fees are probably much more than $50,000 for the plaintiff. So if the defendant's making, let's say, a $30,000 or a $50,000 offer on a $30,000 judgment, but the person's already incurred $75,000 in attorney's fees, is that really a reasonable offer at that point in time? And it allows the court to measure that. On the other hand, if the defendant made that offer 2 weeks into litigation when the attorney's fees are $10,000, it would certainly give the court an ability to measure that as well. That's the purpose.
Any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Marshall, so is it contemplated then that there would be a hearing over the reasonableness of the attorney fees? Is that how this would work?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Marshall.
Yes, there is, just like there is today. There's a hearing today, post-judgment cost hearing. It's no different than what always has happened.
And,
Representative Liebling.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. And Mr. Marshall, I'm just curious, following up on Representative Lesch's questions about if this rule was just changed fairly recently and apparently by the Judicial Council or at least through a process where a change was recommended to the Supreme Court, I'm wondering why you and those who are interested in changing it back didn't go back through that process. It seems a little odd that, you know, they change that and then you're coming here to change it back. Why was that decision made?
Mr. Marshall.
Representative Smith, or Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I answer that question, because the court identifies rules that it wishes to amend and we can offer comment on them. I do not know specifically the process of how somebody can just say, okay, we want a new rule here, court put this up for adoption. I don't know how to say that. Now, I can tell you that I am participating presently in a task force which is looking at ways to improve the civil part of the system, which is being chaired by Judge Bjorkman of the Court of Appeals, but that's more of a process just looking for means and methods, and there's quite a number of practitioners looking in there, and we're looking at all kinds of different things, but it doesn't give us the authority to tell the Supreme Court, here, change this rule. And beyond that, statutory recoveries, in other words, the fee-shifting claims, are a creature of the legislature. They're a creature of this body, and how they are determined and how the courts are expected to determine the guidance should come from here.
Any further? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Marshall, it occurred to me another question that I had when you were just answering Representative Leaving's last question. It's pretty well established around here that anytime someone doesn't like what the courts are doing and then they come up to the legislator to try to change that, especially when it relates to a court rule, it's routinely struck down as a breach of separation of powers or violating separation of powers when it impacts a procedural rule made by the court as opposed to those that are substantive. How can you, are you going to make the argument to the courts when this is challenged, as it inevitably will be, on the grounds that this has to be substantive, not procedural? And is there a note or fiscal note as to how much this is going to cost the taxpayers for this litigation when it inevitably comes up?
Mr. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative, first of all, to answer the last part of your question first, I see no impact fiscally on anything, because at the end of a case, when a party seeks attorney's fees, there is always a hearing on the reasonableness of those fees, in the sense of, do they charge a reasonable amount, how much of that is the court going to award? So there's no impact at all, frankly. As to the other, just as I answered the last question, these fee things, the American rule has always been a party has been responsible for their own fees. And it's in these various statutes that the legislature has decided to create this cost shifting, is how it's labeled in some, or fee shifting in others, since the creation of this body. This body certainly has the authority to determine how that will be ultimately decided.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Marshall, my question was, how can you, and it wasn't really a question about whether there's going to be no cost. It's obviously going to have cost. It's controversial. It will increase litigation, so there will be a cost associated. I mean, we've had fiscal notes on bills that have less of an impact than this, but that aside, that wasn't really my question. My question relates to how are you going to make the impact that modifying this rule, which is the province of the third branch of government, is substantive, not modification of court rules, not procedural.
Mr. Marshall.
Mr. Chairman. I disagree with your premise, Representative, that it's going to increase the cost of litigations. Frankly, I think this will have a sufficient cost reduction in litigation and expense and burden of the courts, unlike the precedent rule has. Be that as it may, like I have indicated before, this is a creation of this body, these fee-shifting statutes. And while the court has a rule, the rule deals with cost shifting. That's what the purpose of Rule 68 under the federal system is. This body has created the law of fee-shifting. For that reason, it's well within the province of this body to regulate it.
Anything else?
Let's have opposition testimony at this time.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good
morning, Mr. Chairman.
Morning.
I
Identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. I've probably testified on this bill almost as much as the post-Labor Day school start time over the years, and I have a slightly different version of history than what Mr. Marshall presented to you. Since the Congress and the legislature started adopting reasonable attorney's fees, lawyers have been arguing over what is reasonable. And at least going back to 1983, the Supreme Court has adopted a standard for reviewing reasonable attorney's fees, and they include the amount of time expended, a reasonable hourly rate, the outcome obtained, the nature and complexity of the case, other factors as justice may require. And the Supreme Court has also, after adopting these standards, the Supreme Court has also specifically addressed and rejected the concept of the bill in front of you, House File 747, finding that the amount recovered should not be the sole factor in determining attorney's fees, and if it were, individuals would have important claims go unrepresented in direct violation of the statutory purpose of the fee shift in the first place. And that was a case in 1986, the city of Riverside, and the Supreme Court wrote a rule limiting attorney's fees and civil rights causes to a proportion of damages, as is proposed here, would seriously undermine Congress's purpose in adopting the statute, and a rule of proportionality would make it difficult, if not impossible, for individuals with meritorious civil rights claims but relatively small potential damages to obtain redress through the courts. This is not a new issue, Mr. Chair and members, for the legislature. And the last time that it was before us, which is in 2005, the identical language to what is in the bill as it relates to not being able to recover your attorney's fees after the offer of judgment was debated in the legislature in 2005, and I've got the bill in front of me. It was House File 1845, posted on April 11th in 2005, and the very identical language that is in this bill was debated by the legislature in 2005. And the result of that is that the Minnesota Supreme Court, through its Rules Committee, engaged in a rewrite of Rule 68, Offers of Judgment. And it specifically did not change the rule. And I would submit to you that if a bill was introduced in 2005 to do what's trying to be accomplished here, and the Supreme Court and the Rule Committee didn't change it in 2008, nothing has changed. And I have the advisory comments from the Supreme Court when they adopted the rule. And what it says regarding the change, this change does not affect a prevailing plaintiff's right to attorney's fees in which it is entitled under law or contract. What Mr. Marshall told you about this new rule changing the award of attorney's fees just didn't happen. That did not take place. And Mr. Chair, remember, there are over 300 different statutes that allow for fee shifting, and they do protect citizens and individuals when they have grievances that need to be resolved. And what I'd like you to know is that the decision to accept an offer on behalf of a defendant is a client's decision. It's the consumer's decision. It's the employee's decision. It's not the lawyer's decision. There may be other important factors that are at stake in the litigation that are beyond what the monetary recovery is, whether it is changing your employment file or removing a disparaging letter of reference that are unrelated to the money, and simply saying that I cannot pursue those claims because I did not get an offer at trial on the money that was greater than what was offered through a Rule 68 motion is unfair. It's specifically been addressed by the Supreme Court Rules Committee and rejected. I would submit to you that the lengthy process that the MDLA, the Association for Justice, all of the bar and the courts participated in cost the courts substantial money to rewrite that rule in 2008. A similar effort would have to take place were this to advance. And so to suggest it has no impact on the courts, I think, is misguided. And lastly, Mr. Chairman, we would object to the provision that we're requires a disclosure of hours when a Rule 68 offer is objected. We think that that requires you to disclose attorney-client information prior to the resolution of the case. We think that is unfair, and if I were a defense counsel, I can submit an offer that is $100, which you know is going to be rejected. But at that point, then, I have to disclose to you the work that I've done on that case to date, who I've interviewed, what time has been expended. That is patently unfair, and we, you know, reject that as being an intrusion into the court's province over the process. That is not a substantive right of the parties. It is a requirement of lawyers that they keep their clients' information confidential, and we think that breaches that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions this time? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Nicholas Slade. I'm a private consumer rights attorney. And while I join Mr. Carlson in many of his views, I want to reiterate that, especially in the field of consumer law, where there are statutory attorney's fees awarded, the proportionality is oftentimes will basically prohibit me from taking cases. A large number of the cases that I represent are people who have been ripped off for a couple $100, maybe $1,000, and the amount of litigation that goes into that, because the defendant, or you know, whoever perpetrated the fraud, which is what I really specialize in, will litigate and litigate and litigate and litigate to the nth degree, so that, because they don't want to admit that they've done something wrong. And so oftentimes the attorney's fees, because I've had to fight so hard to win, and that's an important factor. You don't get attorney's fees if you don't win. You have to be the prevailing party. And so oftentimes when I'm just trying to recover even just a small amount, the attorney's fees instantly become a driving factor, and it's an unfortunate part, but that's the reality. And at a time when they're looking at cutting the legal aid and the amount of money that legal aid has to take a lot of these cases, legal aid is having to shove cases off if they think there's a fee. They shove them over to private attorneys. But we can't take those cases if we're going to have our fees cut. By way of example, about 5 years ago, my partner took a case where an attorney was trying to force a woman to pay $100 more than she owed on a debt. He was trying to impose all sorts of improper fees. My partner ended up defending that case in federal court. Ultimately, he prevailed, and she and to the tune of $43,000 in attorney's fees. There's a long process to going through that. The courts look at every hour you spent. They determine whether it's reasonable, whether it was necessary as part of the achieving the outcome. The courts go through all that process. And they ultimately decided, yes, that was a reasonable attorney's fee award, and awarded my partner $43,000 on defending a woman who the attorney was trying to force her to pay an extra $100. The court went through all that, said proportionality doesn't play a role. These cases, as Mr. Carlson pointed out, these cases won't get defended, they won't get brought, and the people who really need these protections are the people who have low income, middle income. Very few people can afford to get involved in serious litigation. And so to put this proportionality into place is going to cut out a huge swath of people from access to the courts. Thank you.
Very good. Any questions from the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
to testify, then what is the intent of this legislation, then, as you see? Why is it being presented?
Mr. Slade.
Well, Representative, I see it as really it is an intent to cut out a large part of litigation, and basically to prevent people from bringing cases. I think it really is about access to the courts, that if you can't find an attorney who is willing to represent you, you are at an enormous disadvantage in the courts these days. I mean, everything in society is becoming more sophisticated and detailed, and appearing in court without an attorney, when there's an attorney on the other side, I mean, you might as well be jumping in the shark tank. You're going to get ripped to shreds. And absent real representation, people aren't going to prevail, even when they have good claims. And even when they have an attorney, if they know that if they stretch it out and they, like I said, litigate and put you and make you jump through hoops on discovery, on every step of the way, if they drag it out and raise the bar, at some point that attorney's going to start getting gun shy. You know, am I going to get my fees if I really zealously keep representing my client? Are my fees somehow going to be docked because we're starting to get so out of proportion? That's the greatest problem with that proportionality, is it says, well, if you're only fighting over $1,000, well, $1,000 to a lot of the people that I represent is a serious amount of money. And putting in, you know, when I put in 100 hours or more fighting for that, if I have to worry that I'm not going to get paid back, I'm going to start getting gun-shy about representing those people. And so I really do think it's about access to the courts.
Representative Johnson, anything else? Representative Hillstrom, then Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to tell you a little story, and I want you to tell me if this would change the rules. A gas station in my district fired a woman who was a constituent of mine because she was pregnant. And he had previously told her she had health insurance, but in fact, he did not have health insurance on her, and that was why he terminated her. He sued her, or she sued him, and they went to court, and he made an offer to reinstate her, pay her back wages. However, she still would not have had health insurance, and she was going to have bills, of course, for delivering the baby. During the time she was out of work, she went on welfare. At that time, it was called welfare, and the state had substantial costs. If she would have settled for the amount, the state would have been out the money, and she would not have had health insurance, so we would likely have paid the bill as well for the birth of the baby. Would this change in statute take into account those other expenses so that the person who's fighting for, say, reimbursement for the state dollars or for health insurance, would that count if they had made the offer to make them financially whole? Would that be considered a substantial offer under this bill and not subject you to attorney's fees?
Mr. Slade.
Boy, I'm not an employment attorney. But from what you describe, I mean, you're talking more about what kind of things fall within actual damages. I'd be hard-pressed without really knowing more. It's like reading, I can't read about trials in the newspaper because they drive me nuts because there's so much left out. But it sounds like what you're really talking about is the computation of actual damages and what falls within that computation of actual damages. And then you would have to look at the offer and see if they're covering that. But it's really way outside my field. I'm a consumer rights attorney. I specialize in consumer law and not employment law. So I really couldn't answer your question. I'm sorry.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom and members, I'm happy to have one of our employment counsel come and or offline address that, but the answer is yes. And this is specifically something that the Supreme Court Rules Committee looked at, because what they did in the 2 years that they reviewed this rule, they actually changed the rule to provide for a damage-only offer and a total obligation offer. And so this bill doesn't address that in any way. It actually creates a confusion in the law, if this were to pass, between what the rule, the court rule, is and what the law says. And that's why I think they would have to rewrite the rule if this were to pass. If it were a damage-only offer, which would be exclusive of attorney's fees, that did not include the medical benefits, and she didn't get at trial an award that was greater than the offer, absent the medical benefits, she would not be entitled to her attorney's fees beyond the point of that offer. And so that would completely frustrate a major part of her claim, which is to get the health insurance that she was seeking. And that would be completely frustrated were this the law in place at the time of that scenario.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions for Mr. Carlson. Mr. Carlson, do we have any documentation? Does there exist any statements from the Supreme Court Rules Committee when they considered this proposal and expressly rejected it in favor of what we have online now? And were these crazy activist judges just off their rockers when they did this, or what was the deal that why did they make the decision to expressly reject this?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, they did specifically comment on that in their notes to the amendment to Rule 68, and it's my belief that they did not want to adopt the federal rule, and they said in this respect the revised rule, like the former rule — this is why I think Mr. Marshall's missing something here — it's the revised rule, which is like the former rule, does not incorporate the cutoff of attorney fees that occur under the federal rule. And they didn't do that specifically, I believe, because important rights would not be asserted. They didn't want to cut off that right. They knew of the legislation. They heard about the legislation at the Rules Committee. We had several members that participated in it, in that rule update. And they did not want to do what we absolutely think this bill would accomplish, which is to allow important claims to go under or unrepresented by cutting off attorney's fees based on an offer of judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any additional questions? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question I have. Who sits on the Rules Committee? Is it all attorneys, lawyers? Is it a broad base of citizens?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Vogel, the membership of the Supreme Court Rules Committee does change from time to time. It includes law professors, practitioners, district court judges, appellate court judges. And I don't know if there's citizen participation in those legal procedural issues or not. I can find out, but I'm not going to kid you. It's principally made up of the players in the courtroom.
Any other questions? I believe we have one more testifier. Anyone else choosing to testify today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the time, and appreciate you looking at this and the impact on the courts as if it moves forward.
Thank you. For the gentleman sitting down, be brief, because I'm striving to give equal time.
Oh.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey, with the National Federation of Independent Business, and wanted to strongly urge you to pass this bill today. This is an important bill for NFIB. It's an important bill for the Minnesota Chamber and the other 58,000 employers who are members of Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. And this is one of our top priorities. It's an important bill. We want to thank Representative Mazzaro for bringing it forward. Our concern with this law and what's going on currently is that the fee shift too often only shifts one way. And employment law cases are especially concerning to employers. And you've heard from the testimony that sometimes the dollar amounts are low, but the fees are very high. And what's going on in the whole realm of employment law and how that's expanded is very, very concerning to us. And based on the Secretson ruling from way back in 1986, it's very difficult for a prevailing employer who's a defendant to get fees. And so we're seeing too often the fee shift law shifts just one direction, and that is for the plaintiff. And we're pretty much, based on that ruling, it's pretty much a frivolous standard that a defendant who prevails has to prove to have a shot at getting the fees. When you read the fee shift statutes, they seem neutral, but the application of a lot of them, especially employment law, have not been. A couple cases really concerning to us. The whole bill came forward from way back back in the late 90s, I believe, when former Representative Jim Knobloch brought the case based on brought the bill based on what occurred up in St. Cloud. There's a very lopsided award. Two of these are against government, against the library system up in St. Cloud. The fees were very high, in about the $120,000 range, and the plaintiff took a very small award out of it, although she did reject restatement. But in the end, she got very little. Nominal award in the $5,000-$7,000 range, and the fees were extremely high, but she I do want to point out she did reject restatement and moved and did not go back to her old position. We had another case come out of Ramsey County in 07 where $330,000 of attorney's fees were expended that Ramsey County taxpayers had to reimburse the plaintiff, and the total award is $129,000. And so we're seeing some also, aside from the fee shifting law, too often only shifting one way, we're seeing some awards that are just really, really out of balance and very concerning. And I think that is the real salient point about this bill. It's very incremental in our opinion, and it says that if you reject the settlement offer, you take it to trial and incur usually about 50% more costs for everybody, and you get less. You only get the fees up to the point of the offer. And that to us is incremental, and that is an incentive for people to try to settle these problems and not to expend another 50% more for all sides. And so we see the bill as being very incremental. The first section would allow a judge to better examine the reasonableness of the fees, such in the two cases I just mentioned. Where are they in proportion? Why are the fees so much higher than the award? So we see this as a very incremental bill. The fee shift statute is still going to pretty much just shift one way in a lot of these cases that employers care about. But at least this is going to be a little bit of a balancing factor to swing the pendulum back a little bit, promote settlements, and also, you know, hopefully hold fees down for some people who, small businesses, have a hard time paying large fees in many of these cases when this hits them. So just want to strongly urge you to support the bill and appreciate the time.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickey, you're going to have to help me out with this because I do criminal law. I don't do civil. I get paid either way. I mean, if I charge you with fraud, I win or lose. I still get paid. But let's say, for example, I'm trying to understand, are fees related to the amount of time that the lawyers put in on the cases?
Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Representative West.
Okay, so that $120,000 award you're talking about is based on the amount of time. Or $120,000 in fees is based on the amount of time that the plaintiff's attorneys put in, just so I'm clear?
Mr. Hickey.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Well, then I can't understand if you're wrong. And let's take one of your representations. Let's take Wells Fargo on your list here. Wells Fargo fires someone illegally, and they're wrong. You know, one way to reduce those fees is to just roll over early. Not fight it out, not make the other side fight for every dime. So why can't these people on your list just recognize earlier rather than later that they're wrong and that the way to reduce the fees? Am I missing something?
Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, what we're hearing, Representative Lesh, what we're hearing from the defense bar is that a lot of settlements are being delayed, and a lot of times people are making reasonable settlement offers, and the case is just getting delayed, delayed, and delayed. And it's just really concerning. In some of the examples I gave you, it's not all cases. These might be outlier cases, but when the fees get that far out of proportion to the ultimate award, it's pretty concerning. If somebody rejects a settlement offer and the plaintiff gets more, they're going to have to pay all the fees. So this is just a little bit of a safeguard to try to encourage settlements and from things from being dragged out. But if they reject the settlement, if they, the settlement offer is lower than the court verdict, they have to pay everything.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I understand that. It just seems like there's a reason why the courts, the court in its wisdom has decided to enact the rule this way, because someone like Wells Fargo or Viking Coca-Cola Bottling, I love Coca-Cola, by the way, too, so I absolutely like cheap Coca-Cola, but give me a break. They've already got the lawyers on staff, so they're already ginned up and geared up to fight this stuff out. Maybe they need to be given a little pat on the head and say, you know what, when you're wrong, walk away. You don't need to fight every single one all the way out here and make sure that ends earlier. I think that'd be the most obvious ways to reduce these fees, is to be responsible on the part of Wells Fargo or Coca-Cola rather than make the employees pay for it in the long run. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickey, when you only recognize the financial side of these, I believe that's what the bill does. Do you not think it's important to some of these folks to fight for maybe an I'm sorry, or to fight for we'll give you a good letter of recommendation so that you're employable, or we will delete something from your employee file that we illegally put in, or we violated your rights and sent you to do something that you weren't allowed to do, and we're going to make you whole in a different way? Because all this says is that if we offered you a financial amount and you didn't take it, no matter what else the circumstances were, you're not entitled to attorney's fees. So do you not believe that an I'm sorry or I was wrong or making your employment record clean is a valid reason to continue a lawsuit?
Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, I acknowledge that's important too. But the taxpayers in Ramsey County, does it sound good that they had to pay $330,000 in fees when the award came in at $129,000? I mean, we've lost proportion. You got to, members, please keep in mind, this bill is very incremental. It sets up a process. If they reject the settlement offer, take it to trial, and get less, that's the only time the fee is capped. If they reject the settlement offer, take the trial, and get $1 more, they get everything. But we're seeing a fee shift that too often only shifts one way, and some very concerning large amounts of fees are being rolled up. But I understand an apology or a correction of a record could be very important to someone, too.
We need to move this bill along, folks. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, Mr. Hickey, just so I understand, right now, if the judge thinks that the person should have taken the offer, and that they shouldn't have gone on, you know, when we get to the end of the case and the plaintiff wins and the judge looks at the fees and is going to make some kind of award, if they think that a lot of that was wasted effort, they can cut back the attorney fees now, can't they? Is that correct, my understanding of?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I may defer to Mr. Marshall on that, but the front section of the bill, you know, gives the judge a little bit, the section one gives a subdivision one gives the judge little more authority to look at the very thing you're talking about. So I'm not sure to what degree they can really do that now, but I'll defer to Mr. Marshall. I'm not a practitioner, so. But it appears that, you know, subdivision one is trying to give the judge that authority to do it now, so I don't think their power is real great in that area, even though they can review it to some degree.
Representative?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I guess if I'm understanding it wrong, somebody should correct me, but what I'm understanding from this, and I don't do civil either, is that the judge can do this now, and what this bill does is inject a required factor. It kind of ties the judge's hands in considering this reasonableness relationship to damages, but that now they can do that if they want to. So if somebody wins, the plaintiff wins, and the defendant comes in and says, yeah, but these fees are really unreasonable because after this point they didn't need to keep, you know, whatever, doing all this discovery or something, the judge can take that into account now. So if somebody's wrong, if I'm wrong, I hope somebody will tell me, but that's what I'm understanding here. The judge can already do this.
Representative Liebling, I believe that's correct. This would strengthen their hand. Subdivision 1 would clearly strengthen your hand. The anecdote on it was the judge actually, I think, believe somebody from the court or the judge did contact Representative Knobloch back in the mid to late 90s or whatever, and did cite this as a concern. Because I remember, you know, spending a lot of time with Representative Knobloch when he put this bill together, and it really hasn't changed. Yeah, that's why he put section subdivision 1 in there.
Any other questions? Representative Lesh for one final question.
Thank you. I just did. Before that, I wanted to ask briefly, Mr. Chair, if Mr. Hickey could tell me, Minnesota's for lawsuit reform. I see, like, 15 bowling alleys on here. What's with the bowling alleys? Okay, well, you don't need to answer that. I'm just kind of curious. I was going to, Mr. Chair, it strikes me that this bill is a lot more controversial and has implications, much more so than a lot of other bills that we've laid over to determine the fiscal note cost to it because of the litigation arising from the controversy. So, Mr. Chair, I wanted to make the motion to lay the bill over. So that we can get a fiscal note and have the opportunity to actually vote on a bill that we know the price tag. Could I make that motion, Mr. Chair?
Yes. You can proceed to make the motion.
I so make, Mr. Chair, the motion.
Motion's before us. Discussion. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Discussion on the bill. Closing remarks. We're going to move forward. From the author.
Mr. Chair, members, I renew my motion to recommend House File 747 for passage and referral to Civil Law Committee.
Sure. Roll call has been requested on the motion. Take the roll.
Chairman Smith?
Yes.
Vice Chair Shemansky?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Champion? Representative Cornish?
Yes.
Representative Greenhagen?
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Creasel?
Yes.
Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lesh?
No.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Maswell?
Yes.
Representative Marine?
No.
Representative Schumacher?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
Representative Wardlow?
Yes.
There being 10 ayes and 5 nays, motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Westrom, you are next. We do have other bills behind you, so we need to get this presented in, say, 4 minutes, 5 minutes. See, I know you like to talk, Representative. Do your best.
Mr. Chair, I hear what you're saying. You're saying, be brief, brother, be brief.
You do listen on occasion, too. Thank you. Chair moves House File 997. He recommended it pass, be referred to Government Operations and Elections Committee. I believe there's also a DE1 amendment. So the chair moves the amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author wants. So I'd ask for support of that motion. Those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Wake up.
Mr. Chair, I thought it was going to go on 1-0, but... Mr. Chair, I'll be as brief and succinct as I can to the House File 997, Small Business Bill of Rights Regulatory Fairness Act. We are in front of you. What the amendment did, and I'll speak to the bill in the context of the amendment in civil law, some ideas and some questions were raised. We've tried to deal with some of those in that amendment, and I hope most of them. But what it does is it sets... factors that in some cases agencies follow, some of them
already in current process and current rule, but it puts these factors into a statute for agencies to follow as they are working with regulated parties. There's an issue between regulators and regulated parties, and this is an attempt to bring a more cooperative and more of a workable spirit between the regulators and the regulated by putting these factors into statutes so agencies would follow this consistently. Parties that are being regulated and maybe out of violation knowingly or unknowingly would have a process that they could expect, they could follow, and agencies would have a similar process to follow. Some of those issues are that fines and penalties should be similar to what other similarly situated parties are at. How many times has an agency worked with the party to give them remedial measures and corrective action to take the right steps to fix the problem and come into compliance? That's ultimately what the agencies and the regulators are seeking, and that's what the parties are trying to operate and need to operate in compliance. But the idea of giving them an excessive penalty and fine up front and potentially damaging financially or economically their business or putting them out of business when they are a job creator in this state, we think we can do better. We do write some exemptions for imminent harm or in danger to the environment. Those are exceptional situations. We've taken what was a 60-day notice, brought it down to 30-day notice. We've cross-referenced it, so if there is imminent harm, the 30-day notice doesn't need to be required, as Representative Hillstrom pointed out and talked about in Civil Law Committee. Lastly, we've brought up to date, raised the size of a small business. We still have a 500-employee cap up to $30 million in sales as the definition of the small business that this would apply to. And we update or take our Equal Access to Justice Act and mimic the federal government, where a party that prevails against an agency may recover attorney's fees, or if the agency is substantially unjustified in what they initially proposed for a fine, they would be able to recover attorney fees and expenses similar to federal language and federal law right now. And that's the bill and the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone present wanting to be heard on this bill? Testifier. Either for or against, raise your hand. Okay, I'm going to give each one of you 1 minute. Each. Come forward.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business again, and just want to make some brief comments. We strongly support Representative Westrom's bill to expand the Equal Access to Justice law. Our letter is being passed out, but this law and bills had laws had a long history of bipartisan support. It was enacted back in the 80s, and former Senator Ember Young and Representative Tuma strengthened it back in 2000, and Representative Mullery and former Senator Betzel also strengthened it, and we appreciate the fact that there's been bipartisan support that in some instances small businesses can be trampled by regulatory agencies, and we appreciate what Representative Westrom is trying to do to strengthen the bill. I'm not going to run through the whole bill. I don't have enough time, but one of the provisions we really support here, it's taken from the federal law. It's worked well in the federal law from what we've heard, but it's been in the federal law for a long time. But when an agency makes an excessive demand, they also are liable for fees, and then the small business who prevails or largely prevails in that case would not have to take it to the second part of the hearing on substantially justified. And so that's one of the big changes in the bill, and really thank President Westrom for bringing that forward.
Thank you. Next.
Mr. Chairman, it's hard to talk about EATJ in 1 minute, but.
Sir, your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Smith. I'm the director of the Industrial Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thanks for the chance to speak briefly this morning. I'll try and watch the clock here.
I'll help you.
Yeah, thank you. We have a number of concerns about this bill, and we're concerned about the agency's ability to do our regulatory job to protect the environment, to protect the people of Minnesota. And despite the name of the bill as the small business... I'm sorry, the Regulatory Fairness Act, we believe this has negative impacts and implications for Minnesota businesses. Primarily, the reason that's the case is it creates an unlevel playing field for the 90 to 95% of the businesses in Minnesota that are complying with Minnesota's environmental laws. There are a number of issues that I could call out here. I'll focus on a couple of quick ones. This will add to the complexity of the MPCA's business, our process of doing environmental and regulatory compliance determination and enforcement. It will add, despite the desire to make this a more streamlined effort, this will add time and effort on behalf of Minnesota businesses to comply with this law. There are five new provisions that are different and separate from the 12 items on the first page. Seven of those are already in State Statute 116.072. The remaining five are brand new as added to this bill. And make no mistake, those are not simple things for us to comply with as the MPCA, nor are those simple factors and issues for Minnesota businesses to comply with, especially item number 1.198. Item number 8, 1.19 is the number, the person's ability to pay. This will require Minnesota businesses to submit on every enforcement case that we do their financials. Right now, the MPCA, that's already an option that's out there if the businesses want to pursue that. But right now, this bill will require everybody for us to review those that information and require the regulated community to submit that information, adding time and effort on their part towards resolution of the noncompliance. So that's additional work on their behalf. And during these times when we're trying to encourage and speed up government, this is going in the wrong direction as far as we're concerned. And finally, as I mentioned early on, this creates a very unlevel playing field for the 90 to 95% of Minnesota businesses that are doing it correctly. This will encourage people to consider noncompliance. This will take additional time, and for those, again, those folks are doing it right, this will work against them. So we are against this.
Representative Johnson and Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the authors, is there a fiscal note attached to this? I mean, there's obviously new work to be done by the different agencies. That's going to cost money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I understand there's a fiscal note being worked on right now. We don't have it back. I don't see that there should be major expenses if the agencies are already attempting to work with regulated parties and aren't imposing excessive demands. There's not a problem. If they are, well, then we might have a fiscal note issue, but I don't know where it's at. Hopefully we'll get it real soon.
Representative Johnson.
Another question to the author on line 2.15, where it talks about a penalty or stipulation and so on and so forth. My question is, what if the violator destroys a trout brook or wetland and there's nothing to mitigate or remediate? Is there no penalty or no cost to the polluter? What is the effect?
Representative,
that's how I read it.
Representative Johnson, they may have to mitigate what they've damaged, just like they do now. Two, if there's imminent danger to public health or the environment, we give them bypasses in this bill to act swifter, act quicker. You know, if they've wrecked a wetland, what they currently do, in my experience, is they might make them restore that wetland or create another one or a bigger one. Those are all mitigation factors. We also, in the DE1 amendment, allow in what is currently a practice where the part of the fine or penalty might be offset by a environmental mitigation or a stipulated in environmental project, SEPs, that they currently enter into, and that would be something the agency would still be at liberty to do. We just ask them to have it related to the damage or the harm that was done by the party.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it looks like Representative, if something's destroyed, there's really nothing to mitigate or remediate, so I'm not sure how that would apply. And I guess I'm not looking for an answer, but that's how the bill reads.
The gentleman from PCA might even be able to shed light on how they currently proceed with that situation.
Is that another testifier? Who are you talking about?
What's your name?
Mr. Smith.
Perhaps he could inform you on how the pollution control handles restoration of projects right now.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, in the context of repairing a damage that was done through a discharge or release, we would look for an equivalent or related factor. It might be for the creation of a new wetland in the example that you gave. It might be contributing money to an organization that maybe works in the area to restore wetlands or protect waters. So we would look for an equivalent kind of piece there. Although I will mention on page 2, 2.15, that particular language is new to this amendment, and we are a little confused on the reading of this. As we read this, it appears that the flexibility that we normally would create in our supplemental environmental project list, the things that the project proposers actually like us to do as we discuss ways to correct violations and get back into compliance, as well as to protect and repair environmental damage on the local level, this particular provision in this bill seems to restrict that. So we're confused on the intent of this particular language. We think it restricts the flexibility that's already in our negotiations.
Representative Johnson.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's kind of what I was looking for, was that information.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding on line 2.11 of the DE1 amendment, that is taking the place really of what was section 2 in the bill, about the initial violation. Every time we hear this bill, it's always talked about under the guise of pollution control. But this bill is not just about pollution control. And I want to make it very clear to members so you understand when you're voting on this bill that what this does is says that the state agency must give 30 days before initiating an enforcement action. That's not only MPCA, but that's also the Department of Commerce. So one of the areas that I looked at the Department of Commerce website, and one of the areas that they're very active in where we see lots of scamming is in the homeowner industry, right? Scamming people out of the money that they have in equity in their homes. We also saw the entire foreclosure crisis. So I want to make this really clear that what you're now saying is that before the state agency can come in and shut these scammers down, they must give 30 days notice. So that will give these scammers the opportunity to abscond with the money that's in our vulnerable seniors' bank accounts, shred and destroy the evidence, shut down their boiler room or their brains of their operation, expedite their scams to exhaust as many victims as possible, and continue to rip off the citizens during that 30 days. So basically what we know about these kinds of scams is that folks go out and they victimize folks, and then they change their business slightly, and then they do it again in a different fashion. And so what you're saying is the state must not do anything for 30 days, even for the folks that we know are out there doing mortgage fraud, doing those kinds of things. So this isn't just about pollution. This really is about regulation of the bad guys. And you're saying we're not going to be able to do it for 30 days. And so that's why I'm a no, Mr. Chair. And if there hasn't been a roll call already, I request a roll call because I think this goes the wrong direction for Minnesotans.
I'll renew the motion in a minute. One last testifier, if you want to give us your name and what group you represent, and no testimony. Just there's no one else.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. While this is a small business bill of rights, the statute...
Are you for or against the bill?
I'm generally against, because I believe that certain provisions are going to cripple the board's ability to impose the civil penalties that are under Chapter 10A of the law. The bill is written much more broadly than its title suggests. 15.062 Section 1 applies to every state agency imposing any civil penalty. Our typical civil penalties are for failure to file reports on time. Those don't start until 4 weeks after the report was due, because we have communication with people before that. And then they're applied at the rate of $100 per week for up to 10 weeks, where there's ongoing communication. The requirements of this bill to provide additional notice, and in particular to determine the person's ability to pay a civil penalty, is essentially going to stop our efforts to impose these penalties. My other concern is that there are three civil penalties under our law that require intent: intentionally filing a false report, circumvention of Chapter 10A, which is typically giving money through the name of another to hide the disclosure, and finally, earmarking, which also is an intentional violation. While the Section 15.062 says we can consider the willfulness of the violation, Section 2 of the bill says that on a first offense, you can't impose more than 20% of the maximum penalty. Our penalty, was that deleted? I didn't see the amendment. Section 2 is gone. If Section 2 is gone, that's helpful to us. But I think that the provisions are going to make it very difficult for the Campaign Finance Board to continue to assess its civil penalties, and the bill is written too broadly.
Thank you for your testimony. The chair renews his motion. A roll call has been requested.
What's the motion?
Do you have a final comment? Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, real briefly, Representative Hillstrom, injunctions are not being affected at all, and they're absolutely allowed now, currently used, and currently will be used for your situation. Willfulness and intentional harm and harm to the public are also exceptions that are in this bill. So I strongly disagree with your summary of the bill. If there's some areas that we can tighten up that aren't, but you didn't talk about injunctions, and we're not affecting injunctions, which would be a proper measure that would be taken. But
Clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith?
Yes.
Vice Chair Schmansky? Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Chamberlain? Representative Cornish?
Yes.
Representative Greenhalgh?
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Creasel?
Yes.
Representative Ryan? Excuse me. Representative Lesh?
No.
Representative Lieberman?
No.
Representative Maswell?
Yes.
Representative Marin?
No.
Representative Schumacher?
Yep.
Representative Volvo?
Yes.
Representative Volvo?
Yes.
Nine in favor, five against. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee.
The remaining bills that are on today's calendar will be continued to our next regularly scheduled hearing tomorrow morning at 8:15, but it'll be in the basement hearing room. And then we'll meet in the evening back here in room 10. Meeting's adjourned.